This episode contains brief discussion of violence and reference to outdated terminology involving sex work. Listener discretion is advised. This is The Fall Line. To write about crime, we need data. And you might be surprised how difficult it can be to come across accurate accounting of violent crime. Do we truly know the precise number of homicides committed each year in the United States? If you Google that data, you'll certainly get a number. But how has it been compiled? How many murders go unaccounted in certain tabulations? Either because they are ruled accidental deaths or natural deaths, or because statistics aren't recorded by one agency or another. And the number of homicides, that's just one piece of the equation. How many of those homicides are actually getting solved? How many of the same kinds of murders are happening in a particular city or in a particular time period? And what can it indicate? Can that data identify a hotspot, one that could indicate an active serial killer, or even multiple killers? Those questions are just a few that the algorithm developed by the Murder Accountability Project, a volunteer-run organization founded by retired journalist Thomas Hargrove, has set out to answer. The project, nicknamed MAP, was designed to help quantify the FBI's homicide data and create topographical connections between those numbers. That is, to help researchers and law enforcement see, from a macro level, the connections between cases in a given area. And to spot other kinds of problems too, like cities with very low solve rates on homicides, so low that they can actually mimic a hotspot of serial killer activity. Here's how MAP describes their purpose on their official website. Quote, America does a poor job of tracking and accounting for its unsolved homicides. Every year, at least 5,000 killers get away with murder. The rate at which police clear homicides through arrest has declined over the years. Today, about a third go unsolved. As a result, more than 256,000 Americans have perished in unsolved homicides committed since 1980, more than the combined death toll of all U.S. military actions since World War II. In fact, total U.S. military fatalities during the 8-year invasion and occupation of Iraq were less than a single year of civilian losses from unsolved domestic homicides. No one knows the names of all of these victims because no law enforcement agency in America is designed to monitor failed homicide investigations by local police departments. Even the official national statistics on murder are actually estimates and projections based on incomplete reports by police departments that voluntarily choose or refuse to participate in federal crime reporting programs. The Murder Accountability Project is a nonprofit group organized in 2015 and dedicated to educate Americans on the importance of accurately accounting for unsolved homicides within the United States. We seek to obtain information from federal, state, and local governments about unsolved homicides and to publish this information. End quote. At The Fall Line, we've been using MAP's information for 3 years, and we found the algorithm to be incredibly helpful. Looking at Atlanta's unsolved homicide rates and particular eras, for instance, has been a focus of ours. We've discussed the Atlanta hotspot on the show before, the large number of unsolved strangulation deaths in our city that lasted for several decades, from the 1970s through the 1990s. That information was first compiled and recognized by the Murder Accountability Project. MAP has done similar things for other cities, spotted a cluster that indicates troubling activity and warned investigators. Sometimes they know they have an active serial killer or killers, but sometimes they have no idea. Though MAP's board is now made up of 12 members, plus many volunteers who assist with data collection, it all began with former journalist Thomas Hargrove and his interest in data analysis. Per The New Yorker, Hargrove was already a renowned reporter when he first came up with the idea to develop an algorithm to analyze homicide in America. In fact, by the time he began the MAP project, his reporting on SIDS, or sudden infant death syndrome, had a significant effect on both medical and social views of the frequency in which SIDS was assigned as a cause of death. Hargrove did equally complex work in education, discovering that funds meant for low-income schools were often misallocated. He even studied how some people had been erroneously listed as deceased in the Social Security Office's records and the effect that had on their lives. For someone who loves data so much, developing the first algorithm to track murder seems like a natural extension of the work he's been doing all along. I had the chance to sit down with Thomas Hargrove in May of 2021 to discuss his work on the Murder Accountability Project as part of our databases series. Soon after we recorded our interview, a podcast featuring Hargrove's work, Algorithm, was released. We had no idea Algorithm was coming, but we are thrilled to see his work featured in relation to a case, and we hope you'll check it out. Our conversation with Thomas Hargrove was incredibly fascinating. It touched on everything from the crimes of Samuel Little to how everyday people can use the data from his project to advocate in their own cities. I read a great New Yorker article about your years as a journalist, and it seems like you spent your career engaged in deep dives, not only seeking out information, but critically analyzing data and coming to conclusions no one else had. You identified misallocation of school spending, people who've been erroneously declared dead in the Social Security Index and then traced the effects, and you eventually developed MAP yourself, from scratch, working with data sets at your office computer. Can you tell us about the gap or need you saw that inspired you to design your algorithm?
Thank you for having me. And I have, over my years as a reporter, my very first job as a journalist was as a police reporter for a newspaper in Alabama called the Birmingham Post-Herald. It was a wonderful newspaper. And starting out as a cop shop reporter is a great way to start. And while I was down there, I was experiencing live the Atlanta child murders. And the Atlanta Police Department was roundly criticized for not recognizing that there was a pattern of too many African-American youth, mostly boys, who were being murdered. This failure to recognize a pattern has a name in criminology called linkage blindness. And I learned that when I started attending symposiums held around the South about the Atlanta child murders. Criminologists have been aware of the problem of linkage blindness for many years. It comes down to how we investigate homicide. When someone is murdered, a detective is usually assigned to the case and works it. When someone else is murdered, usually a different detective is assigned to the case. If there are commonalities between those two cases, those commonalities don't get recognized unless those two detectives happen to have a conversation about their caseload over the water cooler. If those cases occur in neighboring jurisdiction, that conversation absolutely never happens. The problem of being able to link connected cases, cases that are connected by a common killer, is really quite profound and it has been recognized for many decades. I kept that in the back of my mind, and I was eventually sent to Washington, D.C. to be a Washington correspondent for that same newspaper. And then I eventually became a national correspondent. And while I was a national correspondent, I started doing a study looking into prostitution. In many cities, prostitution laws are hardly ever enforced. In many other cities, they're very strictly enforced so that women who are involved are routinely arrested. In other cities, the men who employ prostitutes are the ones that are the primary target, and they're arrested. In other cities, everybody's is arrested. So I really wanted to study this phenomenon. And to do so, I contacted the database library at the University of Missouri and purchased a copy of the Uniform Crime Report, which is run by the FBI. It is the official accounting of major crime in the United States. And when the CD arrived in the mail, I opened it up, and the librarian had thrown in something that I'd never heard of or seen before for free. It was called the Supplemental Homicide Report. It's supplemental to the Uniform Crime Report. But what it is quite fascinating. It is individual homicides, row after row, case after case, of victims who were murdered. And what you get with that is the age, race, sex, and ethnicity of the victim, the weapon that was used, the year and the month that the victim was killed, the jurisdiction, the police department that handled the investigation, and the age, race, sex, and ethnicity of the offender if an arrest had been made. Also, some circumstances around the case, which is a police theory as to why the crime occurred. I don't know where these thoughts come from, but the first time I opened the SHR, the Supplemental Homicide Report, I wondered if it would be possible to teach a computer to be able to spot linked cases, remembering the problem in Atlanta and the problem of linkage blindness. And I kept thinking about that for years. This was 2004 when I first discovered the SHR. And I bugged my editors and bugged them and bugged them for 6 years. And finally, Peter Copeland, the bureau chief for the now defunct Scripps Howard News Service, said, "Okay, Tom, I'm tired of hearing you. Yes, you can do this. In fact, I'm giving you a year to investigate unsolved murder." And who gets that anymore? But I had a year, and I led a national reporting project that involved all of our newspapers and television stations around the country. And I built a database starting with the FBI data and then augmenting it, because I immediately discovered that there were entire states missing from these data. And so I contacted the states and, under the Freedom of Information Act, was able to compel getting data that had not been voluntarily given to the FBI and work the case. And it turns out that, yes, it is possible. I tried for a summer to develop an algorithm that would identify serial murders. And the technique that was found to work was a technique called cluster analysis, where we group all of the homicides according to the geography, in this case, the county in which the homicide occurred, the victim's sex, the victim's method of killing, the weapon that was employed. And we created a fourth variable. Yes or no, was an arrest made? Was the case cleared through arrest? And then we had the computer calculate a clearance rate for each cluster. And then we looked for clusters that had a very low clearance rate, and we sorted those and brought those up to the top. We were using as our teacher in all of this the Green River Killer, Gary Ridgway, who at the time was the worst known serial killer. This is in the days before Samuel Little took the crown. But Ridgway was convicted for murdering 48 women and teenage girls. And he was convicted, and we could see the data in the FBI data set. The problem was, could we teach a computer to tell us that something awful happened in Seattle? And throughout that summer, we found 100 techniques that don't work, but cluster analysis did work. And Mr. Ridgway's victims popped right to the surface. And it was really very exciting. What was alarming was how many other clusters popped up too that looked just as bad as the Green River Killer. And we started investigating those. In many cases, they were known serial killers. In other cases, they were serial killers that were known to police but were never made public. That happened a couple of times. And in other cases, they were serial killers who were unknown to police. And we tried to get investigations launched on the premise that these could be serial.
We know that MAP uses special coding to identify murder clusters or groupings of unsolved homicides within a certain time frame. What are some of the reasons that a certain region might see a murder cluster?
Well, first of all, clusters occur naturally, that every homicide can be put into a group. And the question is whether there is something unusual about the group. What our system does is to evaluate similar murders involving similar victims who were killed through similar means in a similar geography. And we're looking for clusters that have a suspiciously low clearance rate. And the question is why? And the most charitable answer when finding a cluster of similar murders that had a very, very low clearance rate, the most charitable answer is, well, because there is a serial killer active. The other possibilities are less charitable, at least to local police. It could be that police just have a very low clearance rate, period. And so they're just overwhelmingly not solving murders. That does happen. That happens. And in fact, it's happening in a growing number of communities. Last year, there were 73 major cities where most murders went unsolved. That presents a challenge to the algorithm. Although we're looking for a clearance rate much lower than 50%, we're looking for clearance rates of 25 or 33%, something way down there. But it's true that the murder noise is getting louder as homicide clearance rates decline, and they have been declining for the last 30, 40 years. Beyond that, what other reasonable explanation is there? Police were unlucky. Police just had a hard time with one particular group of unrelated murders. That's why I like to say that usually the most charitable answer is these could be serial. But yes, we know that we get false positives. As you mentioned, I have called this the Flint effect because Flint, Michigan police have a historically low clearance rate, so that all of their murders or most of their murders often look serial because they don't solve very many cases. That's also a problem in places like Baltimore, Chicago, New Orleans, and St. Louis, major cities with low clearance rates. But the algorithm does work. The algorithm has been signaling red alert in Chicago for many years, and we're quite confident that those are related homicides. The police, the Chicago police and the Chicago field office of the FBI have a working relationship, and they have been looking into those homicides of 51 women who were strangled, their bodies were left out of doors, and their cases were not cleared. We are really quite confident that there are at least two or three serial killers responsible for that killing. So the algorithm does work even in a place like Chicago that has a relatively low clearance rate.
That relates to a question we had related to something your site notes. And MAP is really careful to make a distinction between correlation and causation. As in, the site does not make the leap of saying why a cluster or trend exists. Is it the intent for other entities like law enforcement to figure that part out?
Yeah, the board of directors had a struggle on what to do with the algorithm results. We are an all-volunteer group. Nobody is paid. We're a tiny group. Our board of directors now numbers 10. That's not a lot of manpower. And so we don't have the resources to investigate the many clusters that the algorithm identifies as suspicious. What we do say is that the algorithm is identifying homicides that have an elevated probability of containing serial murders. And that is simply the right way to look at it. We know for a fact that there are false positives among the suspicious clusters. And we know for a fact that the algorithm is working, that it is detecting previously unrecognized homicides that have common offenders. It's not perfect. No algorithm ever made is going to be perfect. And the problem of false positives and false negatives is quite legitimate. The algorithm also will not recognize murders in a great many circumstances. For example, Samuel Little is now America's most dangerous serial killer. He has confessed before he died of killing 93 women. That makes him numero uno among this dubious group. He was consistent in how he slew women. He would strangle them. But he was not consistent in where he would do this. He traveled in a quite nomadic lifestyle all over the country. And he traveled so much that a geographic-based algorithm like ours simply cannot link that he killed two women in Sacramento and four women in San Francisco and 15 women in the Los Angeles area. I mean, it just couldn't put all those links together. And anyway, he also killed all over the country. He killed at least three women in Atlanta by strangling them. It was a nightmare scenario and one which the algorithm simply will not detect.
When we were working on the Little case, we really developed a timeline for Little based on his arrest. And this all comes down to a researcher I work with who worked to really, he mapped out almost every single news report, arrest, and he would have him, you know, week by week almost. For instance, when he was in Florida, the day he got out of jail, day of a report, matching him with confessions, days of murders. So he was able to trace, for instance, 3, 4, or 5 months through Florida when Little was there. And he knows when murders occurred. So if you had that kind of information, could a department, for instance, use that to perhaps help identify murders that could match up with Little's MO using MAP?
Absolutely. In fact, that's one of the reasons why we exist, so that homicide detectives can test theories using our data, using actually mostly FBI data or data that we acquired under the Freedom of Information Act. If you have a solid timeline for where Mr. Little was living and exactly when he was there, it's a very simple matter to look at the local homicide records to see if there were any unsolved homicides that might match his MO. He killed women. He strangled them. They were disproportionately African-American, but not all. I happen to know a little bit more than I should about Mr. Little because the authorities asked our assistance in trying to identify Little's victims in Los Angeles. He lived for a number of years in LA, and the FBI was frustrated in their attempts to be able to put names to the victims that he was confessing to, and they reached out to us. We weren't able to provide much help. We did a report on cases in the SHR that might match his descriptions, and we gave them that report. The problem is that, at least in LA, quite a few of his victims apparently were not recorded as homicides, that these were ended up reported as drug overdoses or natural cause deaths or anything but a homicide. Some of the people working the Little files were really quite frustrated. You would think that a man who would strangle women, those cases would be reported as homicides, but they weren't always. Which comes down to a truism in America that a great many deaths are not properly investigated because it's very expensive to do so. And so you have a woman dead in her home. Quite often, it can get missed that she was the victim of a homicide. And they found that a significant number of Little's victims were not recorded as improper deaths. And that's quite alarming. So we'll get false negatives on mobile serial killers. We'll also get false negatives on serial killers who vary their methods. And there have been quite a few. If you have a killer who strangles some victims, shoots others, stabs others, our system simply will fail. And that has definitely been a problem. So this is not perfect. It produces false negatives and false positives. That having been said, we were so concerned that the algorithm clearly is producing important information and clearly is detecting previously unrecognized serial killings, serial crimes, that we decided to make the results of the algorithm available. And so we have. We do so out of a concern for public safety. We hope that police will take notice if there's a big circle over their town. We hope police will call us and we'll tell them why that circle is there. But we hope they'll look into it. It's just with a mouse click, you can download those records that got our algorithm all bothered. And you can check your police files to see if there's a possibility that they're related.
You also hope that the public will use it proactively too, right? I've seen you mention that before, and I find that really interesting. You want citizens to use this data.
We literally are creating an opportunity for armchair detectives. As long as you can put your laptop on your knees in your comfortable chair, it ought to work. You can't do this with your phone, but you can do it with a laptop. You go to murderdata.org and you click on the search cases tab and you can start playing. There are millions and millions of different ways you can set the search switches. And if you've lost someone to homicide, you probably can find that individual case in our data. You'll need to read the 2,000-word essay called How to Use. It's right there at the website. But after you read it, you know how to call up the records. And so you'll be able to find a loved one, a friend. If you've lost someone, you'll be able to find that record 90% of the time. That's how complete the SHR is. It's about, up until recently, it was about 90% complete. And you can see how that case of your, the one you care about, interrelates with similar cases. And if you see a pattern, if you see an awful lot of red, red means unsolved and gray means solved. If you see a lot of red on your screen, that means most of the cases that you're looking at went unsolved. And you might want to explore to see what's going on with that. And if you come away thinking maybe these could be related unsolved murders, you should have a conversation. Call the detective that you've been working with or call us. But we recommend calling the police. And explore the possibility that this might not have been a one-off killing. We do believe that serial murder is much more common than has been acknowledged. The FBI, around 2004, put out a paper, the result of a consortium of expert opinion about serial murder. And they concluded that serial murder is very rare, accounting for less than 1% of homicide. That may be true for murders of men, but it's not true. It absolutely is not true for murders of women. In partnership with the folks who put together the Radford serial killer database, we've done an analysis merging their data to ours. And we can say as an absolute matter of fact that looking at all murders of women, at least 1.7% are known to be serial killings. If you look at all murders of women that were reported to the FBI as being unsolved and later solved, the results are about 4% of cases initially reported as unsolved are in fact the results of known serial killers. Why would that be? Because a serial killer is good at his craft. He is able to commit multiple murders and get away with it. At least he got away with one, the first one. So that he could go on to commit a second murder, which then qualified him to be a serial killer. So by definition, a serial killer disproportionately gets away with his crime. And so we found that at least 4% of women who were murdered and their murders were reported to the FBI as not being cleared, that at least 4% were in fact eventually found to be serial killings.
I actually first heard about the Murder Accountability Project through looking at Atlanta cold cases. And that's when I discovered that MAP had noticed a very large cluster. And I believe at least in 2017, the largest cluster that MAP had identified. And I'm sure you can tell me in a moment if that's still the case, of 133 murders dating back to, I believe, the 1970s. And at the time, my understanding was in partnership with some researchers in Canada, Matt felt that there were at least two serial killers operating in Atlanta during that period of time, and that you were also working with the APD. I wanted to know if there were any updates on that information, if any more data had been developed, any more cases have been added.
No, the short answer is there's not much new. For a while, we were working with the Atlanta Police Department, or at least a cold case unit at Western University in Canada was working with them. All we do are crunch numbers. I mean, you know, we're just a small group of nerds. But it is still true that the largest cluster of suspiciously unsolved homicides are in Atlanta. There were 100 unsolved strangulations out of something like 130 total strangulations. A very, very low clearance rate for that cluster. A very high number of strangulations in that cluster. The NBC affiliate in Atlanta did a series of stories. They were very nice. In fact, you can see some of their stories if you look further back in our news feed. We have videos of their work. The Atlanta Police Department started pushing back on that reporting and insisting that it's not true, that Atlanta did not have a particularly egregious rate of unsolved strangulation murders of women in the 80s and particularly in the 1990s. And they wanted a retraction. The NBC affiliate never gave one. The same week when the police were pushing that there clearly was no serial murder and they wanted a retraction by the NBC affiliate, that same week, Samuel Little announced that he had killed at least three women in Atlanta. And that his victims were among the 100 on our list. It is an anomaly. We don't know why Atlanta had so many unsolved strangulations. We think Atlanta is not a bad police department at all, but this unusual pattern in which a great many sex workers were slain in the 1980s and 1990s is quite curious. And it is still curious. Some of those cases were cleared, but a great many were not. And we don't know why. We no longer have participation from the Atlanta Police Department. I hope someone will continue to look into those. Again, all we can do is point out the fact that there is a very large cluster of highly similar murders in Atlanta, although the calendar continues to march forward. And what are the odds of clearing murders that were 30 years or more ago? I mean, not very good. Cold cases get cleared once in a blue moon, and I think we're looking at multiple blue moons now in the case of the Atlanta strangulations.
In Thomas Hargrove's interviews concerning the Murder Accountability Project, he has stressed again and again how the tool can be used by civilians. Not those looking to solve cold cases, but regular people who want to better understand their cities. I asked him to explain how that data could actually empower citizens. You specifically mentioned, even outside of people who are generally interested in researching a specific case, that just this information is a powerful thing for citizens to have access to understand their own city, to have access to that homicide clearance rate. And that can be powerful information for dealing with politicians, for dealing with citywide decisions that are being made. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, thanks so much for asking that question. That is probably the most important thing we do. We are documenting all, our goal is to document all homicides in the United States and to document whether or not the homicide was cleared through arrest. We hope that the data itself becomes a political force, and we invite all of your listeners, everyone in the United States, to come and look up their hometown. See how many homicides there are in your hometown. See how many of those homicides were cleared through arrest, that offender was arrested. If you don't like what you see, we hope that you don't keep that information to yourself. We hope you'll have a conversation with your mayor, your city council member, your neighborhood association president, that if you're living in a community where a large number of homicides go unsolved, if you're living in a community where most homicides go unsolved, there's not a reason in the world why you should accept that. And you should use your First Amendment rights of speech to point that out. And we hope that every mayor in America realizes that if I don't keep a handle on my murder problem, I'll be facing an opponent someday who promises to succeed where I haven't. We want failure to clear homicide to become a political matter. And we want people to reward politicians who do a good job and to punish politicians who do a bad job. That murder is a serious business, and unsolved murder is a very serious business. We found that murder begets murder, especially unsolved murder, that places that have high failure rates for solving murders also have high murder rates in general. And it's a pretty strong relationship. It doesn't take a genius to figure out why that would be. First of all, if there are a lot of murders, then police are overwhelmed. They don't have the necessary resources to properly investigate a large number of homicides. So they need more resources. That is a political decision. How many homicide detectives, how many forensic technicians, how many experts of every type that is necessary for a successful prosecution of major crime, that is a political decision. And politicians who skimp on supporting law enforcement get what they get. They'll get a higher rate of unsolved murder, and that in turn will bring about a higher rate of murder. And we like to tell anyone who listens that solving murders saves lives. And we think that's simply the truth. So that if people will use our data and talk about our data and talk to politicians about our data, we think we can make murder a little less common.
A talking point from the MAP website really stuck with us, and it was that MAP believes the primary responsibility for the nation's declining homicide clearance rate rests with the failure of will by local political leaders. That really speaks to me about what we were just talking about how citizens, when they have access to those clearance rates, because that's just not something that's given to us, you know, on the local news, can then use it to pressure politicians.
Yeah, we think that a clearance rate for major crimes should be a test for how to evaluate how successful a mayor and a city council are. And if there is a very low clearance rate, and if there's a very high murder rate, I would say those politicians have failed. We don't care who gets elected. We don't take positions politically, but we do hope the data itself becomes a political force. That politicians who are effective, who make solving major crimes a priority, succeed. And frankly, there is quite a bit of evidence that when mayors and county commission presidents, when they make solving homicide and solving major crimes a high priority, usually there is an improvement. Usually the clearance rate improves. And as a result of that, usually there is a decline in the rate of murder. And we hope that continues. We really hope that data become a political force.
We were reading recently that MAP is one of the many organizations that's supporting the Homicide Victims Family Rights Act of 2021, which was reintroduced to Congress earlier this month. Can you describe what this bill would do if signed into law?
Yeah, it really comes down to a best practice. We have quite a few retired cops on our board of directors, and they all love this proposal. It's a good idea. It is a proposal to allow families of murder victims to request a formal review of their case if the case has not been cleared after a number of months, that they could ask for a formal review, make the request in writing, and that the review process not involve the same personnel that conducted the initial investigation. The point of the review is to decide whether there might be new techniques, a different approach might be possible, that if there's something that was overlooked, is there anything we could do with a fresh set of eyes that could evaluate whether we should try another investigation? And this law is only effective for federal law enforcement. Congress doesn't have the power to mandate how local and state law enforcement conducts its business, but they can mandate that the FBI and other federal law enforcement agencies allow for this policy. We think it just makes good sense. In fact, the FBI informally has this policy now that a supervisor can request a new review when nothing has happened in the case. Frankly, this is one of the reasons why America lags most of the Western world in homicide clearance, because we have no layers of review. A few years ago, I gave an address for a gathering of the International Homicide Investigators Association meeting in Washington. And during lunch, after I demonstrated how police can use our data, during lunch, I was sitting with the chief homicide investigator for Denmark. And I asked an obvious question, how many murders does Denmark have a year? And he said, oh, about 50, which just floored me, because Denmark has the same population as the state of Maryland. And Maryland would be giddy if they only had 50 murders a year. And so I asked, well, good heavens, how many of those murders do you clear? And he said, we average about 49. And I stopped eating, because he was claiming matter-of-factly that they have a 98% clearance rate, which probably is why they have only 50 murders a year. And I asked, well, how can that possibly be? You know, here in the United States, we're lucky if we clear 60%. And he said, yeah, I know. What happens is every murder comes across my desk. He's a federal employee, and every murder comes across his desk. If the case is unsolved after a few weeks, he'll call down to the local police department, talk to the homicide detective, and ask, well, what do you need? Why are we not getting anywhere with this case? Do you need resources? Do I need to send people out there? Do I need to come out there? And this guy was sharp as nails. And I thought to myself, I'd hate to be a killer and have this guy on my tail. This idea of having review and having a fresh set of eyes is simply wise. And we don't have that in the United States. So this proposed act of Congress is that first attempt to create a sense that if a case goes unsolved, someone else will take a fresh look at it. It's simply good policy, and we hope it becomes more common. The idea that there ought to be review from higher authority is an excellent idea. It happens in most of the Western world. It does not happen here.
One of the bill's clauses would require the federal government to collect data on cold cases. MAP collects data like this already. So how do you see MAP working in conjunction with an initiative like this, if it were to happen?
You've asked a wonderful question, and I guess now is the time to tell the world that the federal law enforcement community has not been reporting homicides to the public for generations. They're in fact in violation of a law that Congress passed called the Uniform Federal Crime Reporting Act of 1988, which was supposed to take effect. Well, it did take effect on January 1st, 1989, meaning as of January 1st, 1989, federal law enforcement is to document all of their crime investigations, especially homicide investigations, reporting to the Uniform Crime Report and to the Supplementary Homicide Report. Nobody did. Despite that law, the federal government has not reported murders and has not reported case-level information of any sort. The largest offenders of this law are the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Department of Defense. They have the largest number of homicides that they investigate, and they've never documented to the official accounting of crime any of those homicides or other major crimes. So it's interesting that this proposed bill, which is meant to be a salve to families of homicide victims, it's interesting that it adds a new data reporting requirement, which is that the National Institute of Justice shall publish annual statistics on the number of cold cases. It should be pointed out that neither the National Institute of Justice or anyone else has ever reported on the number of federal homicide investigations. Zero. We are confident that there are thousands of such cases. They've just never been reported. So we would applaud this report and any other report. We are in court right now. We have a case pending before U.S. District Judge Amy Berman Jackson, who has made news in Freedom of Information Act trials in the past. We are trying to compel the FBI, the Department of Defense, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the National Park Service, and anyone else we can think of who investigate homicides. We are trying to compel them to report 32 years worth of unreported homicides. We are making this claim under the Freedom of Information Act and under the Uniform Federal Crime Reporting Act of 1988. So we hope that this cold case report comes to existence. But right now, nothing has been reported. And I mean nothing for a very long time. So that we hope that this new law is passed by Congress. It's a very good idea. And we would like to see special reporting on cold cases under federal jurisdiction.
So, the FBI has in the past had two systems to gather data on crime nationwide. One is the summary reporting system, which certainly has its problems, but according to the New York Times, is used by roughly 90% of law enforcement agencies to report their annual data. The other system is the National Incident-Based Reporting System, or NIBRS. Put simply, NIBRS is much more complicated, and it collects much more data on a single incident. Beginning this year, the FBI has discontinued use of SRS and is requiring agencies to use NIBRS. What will that mean for national data moving forward?
Yeah, first of all, the Murder Accountability Project is solidly in favor of the NIBRS standard. It's a very good idea. It provides a wealth of information about all of the indexed crimes counted in the Uniform Crime Report. We absolutely recommend to all law enforcement agencies to work to adapt to this new reporting standard, which is much more complex and much more complete in the amount of information they have to report every year. The data collected is essentially the level of detail that we've been getting through the Supplemental Homicide Report for all major crimes, for robberies, burglaries, sexual assault, in that it's supposed to name the age, race, sex, gender, ethnicity of every victim, and if an arrest is made, similar demographic information about offenders, weapons used, if any weapons were used, dollar amounts and the value of property stolen. Anyway, a wealth of information at the individual case level. It is a large amount of information that police are being asked to provide the federal government. That having been said, we think it's a very good idea. We think that all crimes, major crimes, should be carefully documented. And we think that in the end, law enforcement will benefit from the adoption of the NIBRS standard. Only about half of the police departments last year were able to meet the NIBRS standard. What that means is we're approaching a data train wreck this year, that because police cannot report unless they're reporting via the NIBRS standard, and because half of police departments could not meet that standard last year, we are convinced that thousands upon thousands of homicides will go unreported this year because of the new standard. We are going to try to urge states and major municipalities to continue to report data to us under the old standard until they're able to become NIBRS compliant. And we are going to be contacting them starting this month. We recognize the problem. This is not the year to lose half of our records in crime, because we had a tremendous explosion in homicide last year. Our best estimates is we saw a 20 to 25% increase in murders in 1 year. That's the largest 1 year jump in homicide in history. We need to study that. We need to know why it happened. We need to have information down to the local level in every locality. We want to know places where there was no jump in murder because something went right there. We need to know what happened in places where there was a 30, 40, 50% increase in murder. We need to know where they were, the amount of increase, and other factors, because hopefully we can figure out how to prevent that from happening again. Now is not the time for half the country to go dark, but that's exactly what's about to happen.
I can't think of a more important year to be able to analyze accurately, especially when there's already issues with city, county, state, you know, like that. Those are, you're already up against that.
Whenever you mention this issue, if you urge people to continue reporting, we, you know, that your group urges what we urge, that police continue to report and publicly release data under the old format until they're able to meet the new format.
What's the best way for our listeners to communicate that to police, to city officials?
Just to have a conversation when they're talking about murder with their mayor or their city council member, it would make sense to make sure that the police department is adequately reporting the data. It's good to know how transparent your local police department is. And since half of the country is about to go dark, we hope that that also becomes a political conversation. I don't want darkness when it comes to major crimes. I want the whole world to know what's happening in my community. It's called transparency. It is a very democratic idea. And the necessity of transparency, especially in times when we're facing unique problems, is more important than ever. And so we're hoping that people will talk to their politicians. They don't like what they see in the homicide data. And also they want to make sure that the data continue to flow, that we don't want the state to stop reporting data. We sued the state of Illinois 6 years ago because the entire state was not reporting how often they clear homicides. We tried to get the data. Unfortunately, we failed because the state of Illinois was able to convince our judge. The reason we did not give the Murder Accountability Project the data they sought is because we don't collect that data. We don't gather statistics on how often murders are cleared. And so when we got that answer, we contacted the 102 police departments in Illinois under the Freedom of Information Act, asking them to tell us how many homicides have they cleared in the last 2 years under the Justice Department's definition of clearance, which is at least one person was arrested in the case, formally charged and handed over for trial to a court of law. We got back data. And when we finished crunching the data, we found out that Illinois has the lowest statewide clearance rate in the nation. That's what happens when you keep your eyes wide shut if you insist on not keeping an eye on the homicide problem, the homicide problem is not going to get good. It is going to go south. And Illinois is the only state in the nation that does not report how many cases are cleared through arrest. And it also has the lowest clearance rate. Transparency is important. And I cannot say that too often. If we can't see that we have a problem, we can't fix the problem.
And you saw those huge clusters in Chicago.
Yeah. So the Chicago Police Department, to their credit, was the one of only two police departments in Illinois that continued to report SHR data, supplementary homicide report data, to the FBI. For decades, the entire state of Illinois stopped reporting those records. And Chicago continued to report them and bless them. And because of that, we were able to detect a very likely collection of serial murders in Chicago, 51 strangulations of women, all of their bodies recovered out of doors in trash cans, empty alleyways, abandoned buildings. It was a very strong MO. In fact, I've said many times, when you look at the nature of these 51 cases, they just scream serial murder. And we're quite confident. And the Chicago Police Department don't disagree. They have made attempts to review these 51 cases, and they've been working with the FBI. And together, they investigate whenever there are any leads trying to clear these 51 cases. They did make an arrest in one case, and they announced when they made the arrest that they thought he was a serial killer, that he may have been responsible for two other murders. Unfortunately, he was not one of our serial killers. It doesn't look like he was the predator that we are convinced is responsible for most of these murders. So it's one for the books. They caught a serial killer. It just wasn't the right serial killer. So that we continue to look in the remaining 50 cases, looking for a clue that might help the Chicago Police Department make an arrest. They are decent, hardworking men and women in the Chicago Police Department. They are overwhelmed. They don't have enough resources of every kind, but they're trying, and we know they're trying.
You can support MAP in a number of ways, including tax-deductible donations, support of their initiatives, and volunteering. There's a link in our show notes to learn more about their work. Thanks so much to Thomas Hargrove for taking the time to speak with us for the show. And thank you for listening. The Fall Line is a fully independent show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIAs, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise on our shows, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us over on Patreon. We're raising Patreon funds to continue to fund the Millbrook Twins billboard and begin a therapy fund for families who've been on the show. You can read a public post about those goals on our Patreon page. On Patreon, you get early release ad-free versions of our regular episodes, plus blogs and videos for only $5 a month. We've also added video live streams, which all patrons can enjoy, starting at just a dollar. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters and Kim Fritz. Family and law enforcement interviews are by Brooke Hargrove. Produced, engineered, and scored by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd. Currently, our monthly donation is going to private investigations for the missing. Please join us in supporting this nonprofit. They need funds to help families access the service of private investigators. You can find a link in our show notes.